Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Janine Dixon, the Educational Outreach Coordinator here at the Center for Science and Culture. Recently, talk radio host Michael Medved was gracious and eloquent in explaining the work we do at the Center for Science and Culture. He asked listeners to make their tax-deductible year-end contributions accordingly.
A great Christmas present for anyone on your list would be a contribution in someone's honor to the Center for Science and Culture of Discovery Institute. And anyone who gives $150 or more to Discovery Institute will have a beautiful gift edition of the magnificent new documentary. It is a nature documentary, kind of thing that would make Walt Disney proud, except no scientific questions about this one. This is very handsomely mounted and very carefully photographed and edited. It is called Flight, the Genius of Birds. And it actually asks some of the questions about the mysteries of these birds that have remarkably sophisticated functioning, and not just in terms of their flight.
Some of you may be considering giving a gift to your college alma mater, yet many of those same colleges and universities have contributed to the persecution of pro-ID scientists. There's a better way to direct gifts to the cause of educating future generations. That's by supporting the Center for Science and Culture. Any amount helps, but as Michael said, a $150 gift will get you a free DVD of Flight, the Genius of Birds. Please help us by going to intelligentdesign.org and making a year-end donation. That's www.intelligentdesign.org. Thank you, and now back to the podcast.
Greetings and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. We have right here today in Seattle with us a very special guest, Dr. David Berlinski, a senior fellow at Discovery Institute and author of many books that I'm sure our ID the Future listeners are familiar with, including The Devil's Delusion, The Deniable Darwin, A Tour of the Calculus, and most recently, The King of Infinite Space. And that's a story about Euclid, isn't it,
Dr. Berlinski? That's a story about Euclid.
Dr. Berlinski, thank you so much for coming out here to Seattle so we can have some enjoyable conversations today.
It's my pleasure entirely to be here with the sick and afflicted Casey Luskin snoring in my hotel room like Typhoid Mary.
Well, I'll try to look the other way when I'm coughing and hacking so it doesn't get caught on the microphone here too much, or in fact you either. You've got a lot of interesting projects that you are working on and things that you have worked on in the past. There's a lot to talk about, but right now I know that you are working on an interesting project responding to some arguments by Steven Pinker. And the way I understand these arguments, Dr. Berlinski, is that Pinker believes that the world is getting better, especially when you look at the realm of violence in human history, that over time violence has decreased. I assume he's arguing, you know, we become more civilized. We no longer just slit our neighbor's throat if we don't agree with them. We don't enslave our brothers or our sisters if they don't pay us back. We are evolving. You know, I'm a big Star Trek fan, so this follows the Star Trek narrative. We're shedding our primitive, superstitious, and animal-esque behaviors, and we're evolving to a higher plane of existence. I'd like to talk to you about Dr. Pinker's arguments. I know that you have read them in depth, and you've developed quite a bit in response. Can you tell us first about what is Pinker arguing, and what is his basis for arguing that human history is a story of improvement?
Well, and look, Steven Pinker has written a book called The Better Angels of Our Nature, and it is 800 pages, extremely ambitious book because it encompasses all of human history from the Neolithic era to the present moment, say 2007 or 2008 when the book appeared. And Pinker's essential argument is, look, certainly the 20th century was just terrible. Nobody denies that. But if we examine human history in its longest sweep over historical, almost geological times, we can see a steady, a systematic, occasionally an erratic decline in the level of violence. And this decline, especially in the last 400 years, is amplified by an improvement in social conditions, an increasing amelioration in the savagery of human nature, an increasing tolerance and acceptance of diversity that's especially conspicuous in Western Europe, say from 1950 to the present, and some parts of the United States, remarkably so, Harvard of all places. So this is a very ambitious kind of claim, and it is, of course, an extremely important kind of claim. If true, it's cause for optimism. If false, it's cause for quite another reaction. Now, I've gone through Pinker's book very carefully, and it is a complex and impressive piece of work. There's no question about that. It is, in theory, supposed to be scientific and quantitative. Those are its two adjectives. Whether it is for that reason true is another question entirely. My own feeling is that it is largely untrue, badly argued, and poorly supported by statistical evidence.
Okay, so you mentioned the 20th century. Does Pinker recognize that the 20th century was one of the most violent periods of human history? The body count is just off the scale.
No. The 20th century was not one of, it was the most violent period in human history. Pinker does make a few excursions into what I can only call fabulist history, saying that, for example, the First and Second World War, the Holocaust, the Great Terror in Stalin's Russia, these weren't the worst of all possible events. If you go back to the 9th and 8th centuries in China, there was a tax rebellion that seemed to have killed more people. But that is the weakest part of his argument, because after all, we had very poor documentary evidence for this period of time. And as comparing the present to the distant past, of course, our concerns, the gravamen of our concerns, is with our own time, as it is and must be. Look, this is not a doctrine of indifference to the historical dead. They lie stacked in history like bones, each one, no doubt about that. But while we can still, in 2014, mourn the dead at the Battle of the Somme, they still bring tears to our eyes. No one is the least concerned with the dead from the Napoleonic Wars, which were also horrific. That is just part of our human nature. We are most concerned to appreciate and understand what is most recent. So stories about tax rebellions in 8th century China, or stories about the Mongol invasion, two reasons to not take them all that seriously. The first is that the statistical evidence is simply nugatory. We really don't know how many people died in those events. And the second is they are not proximate to our concerns. Those are two very important reasons.
So what is, according to Pinker's narrative, what are the implications of all of this? Is human nature improving? Is it that somehow science is, as you said, bringing us better living conditions? And so science is sort of ultimately responsible for this decline in violence. What is the moral argument that he's making here, or the larger implication?
I'm not sure that Pinker would agree that he's making a moral argument. Plainly, he thinks it's a good thing that violence has declined. And if it has declined, I think it's a good thing, too. That's not really at issue. When he calls his treatment a scientific assessment, he really doesn't mean scientific. Physics has nothing to offer us. He means historical and, most importantly, sociological. Pinker, like a number of other criminologists and sociologists, thinks there's been a long-term decline. By long-term, I now mean 800 years or so. In the level of criminal violence, because of sociological transformations. And he takes his ideas from a German sociologist named Norbert Elias, who wrote a book in 1938 in German, called The Civilizing Process. Now, if that by itself is not irony approaching iridescent coloration, I don't know what is, because of course his book was refused publication in Germany. He had to go to Switzerland and published it privately. And he had reason to reflect upon or regret that title when he discovered the civilizing process in action when they took his own mother and deported her to Auschwitz. Elias had a very interesting argument. It was part historical, part sociological. He was very influenced by Max Weber. He was also influenced by Freud. He was influenced by a certain tradition in German sociology. His argument was that, and this again is an example of irony, because Pinker earned his reputation as an evolutionary psychologist committed to some doctrine of innate ideas, especially with respect to language. Elias argued, au contraire, that human nature, and this is a quote, is second nature. What did he mean by second nature? He meant, and here he used a Latin word, habitus, which I guess you could translate as the acquired habits as they occur in social, political, and especially commercial life. And Elias argued that in the 16th century, as commercial life became far more reticulated and complex, there was an inevitable increase in the complexity of the human mechanism of self-control. People learned that if they wanted to prosper, if they wanted to master the network of relationships, they would have to defer satisfaction in some domains, anticipate the future better than they had a century or two centuries before. And that as the result of this very complicated sociological process, you can see between, say, the years 1475 and 1700, a definite improvement in the human ability to control homicidal, in particular, or violent in general tendencies. Pinker takes that as axiomatic, that Norbert Elias has provided an explanation for the decline in violence, as Pinker imagines it, took place from, say, the 13th century to the 20th century. He also believes that Hobbes provided, at least in part, a theoretical justification for the state in terms of the state's power, Max Weber's formulation, to form a monopoly on the control of violence, and by so doing, eliminate anarchic tendencies within the state, which had flourished from time immemorial, to augment the level of communal violence. Of course, in all this, Pinker takes as axiomatic what a great many other historians, including very good historians like Lawrence Stone, take as axiomatic, that if you look at a measurable quantity like homicide from, say, 1240 to 1950, what you see in Lawrence Stone's words is an astonishing 800-year decline in the level of violence, where, for example, 1300, Warwick or Oxford or London had something like 100 to 125 homicides per 100,000 inhabitants. Contemporary figures are much, much lower, orders of magnitude lower, so that London in 1950 has less than one homicide per 100,000. Of course, this entire apparatus of data and explanation falls to the ground if you have grave doubts about the 800-year decline in violence. And of course, the minute you go back to the sources, those doubts don't emerge to a crowd. They emerge as a multitude. The evidence simply does not bear scrutiny.
So tell us about this. Why does this argument, this empirical argument, supposedly, that violence has declined, why are you skeptical of this argument? Why do you have these doubts?
Well, let's stick to homicide. Because homicide is something apparently we can measure. And to a certain extent, that's true. I don't argue with that. You want to know, is the rate of homicide, or was the rate of homicide, worse in Oxford or Warwick in 1300 than it is today? By today, let's say from 1914 to the present. Let's not be too specific about the exact period of time involved. Well, criminologists and historians generally base their assessment of homicide by using a particular statistic, number of homicides per 100,000. Well, per 100,000 what? Usually the base, the denominator, is with reference to a particular city. So if Oxford had 100,000 people and they had 100 homicides, it's 100 homicides per 100,000 people. But if Oxford had 1 million, then it's adjusted. So the same proportion, 100 per 100,000 or 10,000 per 1 million, whatever it is. The same fraction holds. Bear in mind, there are two questions. The number of homicides, which in the 13th century are known with some accuracy because there were courts specifically designated to measure and report the number of dead. That doesn't happen in the 16th and 17th century where coroner's reports come in. What about the denominator? The denominator must reflect the size of the city, and that's a very sensitive statistic. If you're off in estimating the population of London, if the population of London was not 40,000, but 80,000, the number of homicides immediately declines. That's a crucial statistic. Well, open question, how many people were living in London in 1300?
No idea.
unfortunately, that's true for the historians as well. Now, there are some cities, London included, where there were more or less reliable censuses taken between, say, the period of 1340, when the first historical surveys are made, and 1400. Oxford is not among them. Warwick is not among them. Well, how do historians know how large these cities really were? In the late 11th century, the Norman kings commissioned a population survey of England called the Domesday Book. So we have some records from the 11th century of how populous these cities really were. How many people were living in Oxford in 1320, say? Well, you take the figures from the Domesday Book in 1080 or 1070, and you apply a natural rate of increase. What's the trouble with that statistical procedure? Well, you have one figure, X. That's the population in the 11th century. You have another figure, the natural rate of increase, which gives you Y, the population estimated for 1320. But what you cannot do with Y is measure it against anything. You have no idea whether the natural rate of increase corresponds to a natural rate of increase. There is no way of verifying this kind of deduction. It is all very much like, as Wittgenstein said in another context, buying one copy of the New York Times in order to verify what you've read in the first copy of the New York Times. So there's a fundamental uncertainty, a fatal uncertainty in my mind about all population estimates before the modern census emerged. And the modern census emerged when? 1792 in the United States, 1801 in Great Britain, right around there. I may have those figures reversed. But modern population statistics are no more than 200 years old. So everything we're calculating about the distant past, 800 years is a long time ago, has to be accepted modulo a tremendous amount of skepticism, because the slightest variation in the underlying population statistics throws all comparisons off. If you say that London had a population of 40,000, its homicide rates are off the chart. If you say it had a population of 80,000 or 120,000, I've seen both estimates, then you say the crime rates are pretty much what they're like in Cambridge, Massachusetts, right now. Given this, it's very hard to know what to say about an 800-year decline in homicide rates. But this is typical. The decline in homicide rates over 800 years seems to me much less important, much less pertinent than another statistic which is far better attested. Namely, there's been a rise in homicide since 1960, one which criminologists cannot explain. There are a lot of theories, but no entirely credible or persuasive theory. So here, on the one hand, you have a completely contemporary statistic. Crime rates are understood to increase from 1960 throughout Western Europe, the United States, explosively in some parts of the United States. Nobody quite knows why that's happening. And you have, in comparison, a fable, the mythical 800-year decline in homicide rates as between England, Scandinavian countries, and contemporary United States, which no one really knows whether it is entirely serious. This seems to me to have everything backwards. We have much less faith in our statistical or quantitative assessment of late medieval history than we do in the contemporary era. So it seems to me this is a spectacular example of historical analysis that gets things backward, that is moving entirely in the wrong direction. We just don't know what the 800-year, that's far too long a period of time, and too much of it's anchored in a period of time in which contemporary assessments, statistical assessments, simply were inexistent. They weren't there.
I'd like to come back to the issue of the explosive rise in crime rate since the 1960s. But unfortunately, we're running out of time for this podcast, Dr. Berlinski. So we're going to come back real soon with more with Dr. David Berlinski talking about whether or not society is becoming less violent over time. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2013. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.